Right.
We will first begin with a little bit of review. Yesterday, we began talking about a very difficult task, talking about mood, and how each mood has its own internal psychology, and there is a consistency, a psychologic to each mood. We actually, in doing that, we tried to define what a mood was, or to give meaning to the word mood. And we saw in that definition that one's entire emotional nature, most of which we are unconscious of, not aware of the influence of our religious background and how that all of our feelings are tainted by it and all of the other things that make up a constant state of feeling that is our mood. We said at that time, and we're going to look at it a little bit more today, that the whole zodiac itself is a mood, and that each of the signs within the zodiac is a mood. And we talked about each animal species having a mood of the animal group spirit that is behind that species. We talked about how the animal idiosyncrasies can be found as psychological minutiae of the group spirit of the animals, and that the group spirit of the animals is reflecting from universal ideas in the world of ideational thought. These details are not important. We talked about Aristotelianism and its value, but how, in terms of spiritual creation, Platonism is more important. Finally, we talked about how in ourselves, how much more important it is for us as individuals, as wholes, to be able to understand ourselves as a whole, and then each of the little things fits into that and has meaning within that. We're talking about desire. The whole series in the afternoon is called Astrology and Desire, because it maybe is not as important of a topic as building the soul body, which we talked about last year, but it is our greatest nemesis, working with desire and all the difficulties that we have with desire. And we're talking about that principle of working with all desire and going to the very heart of desire itself in order to be able to work well with it. And the idea is so important that we'll take a little side trip and go into a story that illustrates the point. And the story is both a classic and it is classical. It is from the myths about Heracles, and Heracles is who the profane Romans call Hercules. So let's talk about Heracles. We'll take one small fragment, and even at that, we'll just look glancingly at it. It's from the 12 labors of Heracles. Heracles was a hero, and all of the heroes and hero myths are myths that are about initiation, or about people who are candidates for initiation and what they must go through to become initiated. The 12 labors of Heracles are associated with the 12 signs of the zodiac. They've been very well studied, and a lot of people have written on the subject, including Isaac Newton has a treatise that he wrote on the subject of the labors of Heracles. But the thing that's most important about the 12 labors, or the works that precede each of the 12 initiations, is that they're based on basic ideas which are built right into our character. As we have come to be what we are now, the potentialities of what we are now unfolding and bringing to life that were put into us are the very key things of the universe itself. We are microcosms of the universe. And initiation is just a fast way of growing up inside the universe. And so that's what, so you'd expect it to be exactly like that. Even in the story, the 12 labors were set down by Hera, who was jealous of Heracles because he was the son of Zeus and someone other than his wife Hera. And in order for him to be deified, he had to go through these 12 steps. And each one of them developed another part of his own being. So it's described in some mythology books that the 12 labors are the steps of apotheosis, which is a fancy name of becoming a divinity. In almost all versions of the 12 labors, the first labor is the slaying of the Nemean lion. And the second labor, in almost all versions, is the slaying of the monstrous Lernaean hydra. Now, we're going to interpret this myth from one point of view, and there are other points of view that can be done. To look at it a little bit cosmologically. Cosmology is the study of how the cosmos works, what kind of logic underlies it, and the way everything works out. All of part two of the cosmo conception is cosmology. This is almost perfect because initiation is a condensed version of cosmology. Rosicrucian school, if one goes through initiation, one goes through the very stages that humanity went through in the past and will be going through in the future, only it's done in a really fast, rapid-fire way. In part two of the cosmic conception, we are told that the sign and constellation, both of Pisces, stand for the chemical region of the physical world. And they also stand for our life wave, our humanity. And there's obviously a tie there that the minerals are now and the life that is within them will be for a very long time our charge, our evolutionary work in helping them to evolve. The Aquarius, in that same section of cosmology, stands for the etheric realm and for the life wave that is associated with that etheric realm, the angelic life wave. Similarly, the macrocosmic desire world is ruled by Capricorn and the archangels that work through and within the principle of desire. Finally, the world of thought is ruled by Sagittarius, and the lords of mind, or the archai, or the power of darkness, or whatever name you want to give them, are also ruled by that. Now, it is a principle in cosmological astrology that the macrocosm is indicated by one sign and house, and the microcosm is indicated by the opposite sign in house. So according to this, Pisces rules the material world and humanity, the material world, the dense physical matter, in macrocosm. In microcosm, in us, Virgo and the sixth house rule the physical body. We don't do so much with Virgo anymore that way, though it's a very fruitful thing to do, but the sixth house represents the state and health of the physical body. Similarly, if the ethers are ruled by Aquarius, the etheric vital body is ruled by the fifth house and by the sun. So it's not surprising that Greek mythology says the same thing that Max Heindel says over and over again. All occult development, all spiritual progress begins with the vital body. And so the first labor that Heracles has to do is he has to overpower the Nemean lion. And when he does that, he flays it using its own claws to flay it, because it's such a tough hide that he can't, no knife will cut it. Meaning this is the same, what this is saying is that any world or any body is overcome by the tools that are operative in that body and in that world. And ever after, if you ever see pictures of Heracles, you see the open lion's mouth over his head, and he's wearing the lion's skin as a almost like a Superman cape or something like that. And the reason he does that is because he's invulnerable. As long as he's wearing the lion's cape, spears and swords and arrows can't penetrate. But this is exactly what happens if one has what in the alchemy was called the diamond hard soul body. That if we develop our etheric bodies so that we live in a crystal of light that is our consciousness, we're invulnerable to psychic attack. We don't have to worry about any defenses or anything like that, because we walk in the light and we live solidly in the light. Then we come to the task that we're talking about now. That is the slaying of the Lernaean Hydra, which means overcoming the desire body or working with the desire body. According to the myth, before the Hydra hides in a cave, and before he can get at it, he has to get it out of the cave. And what he does is he shoots flaming arrows into the cave until the Hydra comes out. And when it comes out, he can battle with it. Now, we won't go into all of the things, because there's much more than we can really go into. But the cave is exactly where our desire nature is. It's invisible to us. It's hidden. You know, we go along and say, la-di-da, wouldn't it be nice to have a chocolate bar? You know, and without realizing, from deep within our desire body, that pseudo-self, that fake ego, wants to maintain control, and it knows it can do that as long as we're living in desire. And so as long as it keeps us, as long as we're in the dark, as it's in the cave, then we can't see it, it can have power over us. So the cosmic conception tells us that everything in the desire world begins in the central region of the desire world. In fact, all tomorrow's talk is going to be talking about the central region of the desire world. The next three talks are going to be an astrological tour of the desire world. Tomorrow we will talk about the central region of the desire world, and Thursday we will talk about the lower part of the desire world, and Friday we'll talk about the higher part of the desire world. So everything in the desire world begins in the central region. And that central region is the region of interest. One has the region of feeling, and the chief feeling is the feeling of interest. And what this is saying is that before we can have an experience of desire, we have to be interested in something. We have to feel its existence. And if you start throwing flaming arrows at something, that certainly gets your attention. Whether the flaming arrows are thoughts or whether they represent objects in the desire world that get the attention. At any rate, Heracles is got the attention of the Hydra. But he gets a little bit ambitious. Sometimes people, Heracles probably wasn't the smartest of all the heroes. That's the way it works. The people who do things by brawn and who do things by force don't always have the finesse. You know that heroes come in all the flavors of the planets. That is, there are mercurial heroes and there are Venusian heroes, and they each have different sets of trials. We each have a different ray that we belong to, and when we come to initiation, our initiations are in tune with the ray that we are part of. So, Heracles, being a martial type, starts grabbing tentacles that have heads on them, and he starts bashing them. And he tries to subdue them. He just tries to smother them out. But it doesn't work well. What happens is, every time that he crushes a head on the head of a tentacle, in a little bit of time, seven new heads come out where the one was before. And pretty soon he's in a whole forest of tentacles with heads on. He says, oops, maybe I better go about this differently. sounds like desire, doesn't it? If you try to deal with one desire at a time, you're never going to do it. You have to get to the central principle of desire. One at a time never does it. And if you try to crush desire with your will, all you do is repress it. And when you repress it, since nothing in the desire world can die, all you've done is you compressed it and you made it like hydraulic oil. It has much more push to it. Yeah, and so one desire becomes squeaking out the sides as many different kinds of desires. So he's entangled in all these tentacles with heads on and things like that. According to some versions of the myth, a giant crab comes out of the ocean and grabs him around the ankle, but that's a little too obvious for me. You know, like nobody agrees on all of the myths, what is the full content or not. I think that this the crab version, if the Hydra wasn't enough, the crab version is sort of like mythology for dummies. That if you're going to connect it with cancer, well, we better make sure you don't miss the point. So he is actually led by Athena, and Athena is a lunar goddess. And she and the moon rules Cancer, and by wisdom, he is led to find the central head. And when he finds the central head, or the most basic of all desires, which we talked a little bit about yesterday, which is basically the desire to be fulfilled or the desire to be complete in the incompletion of our separative existence in the manifest cosmos, that's the basic desire, and if we can get at that, then we can get at the root of all desire. Moreover, Athena teaches him that if he takes a torch, and after he has lopped the head off, if he brings fire to it, spiritually renewing creative fire to it, it won't come back. You need to say that if we take the desires and destroy their negative propensities and turn them to something positive and creative, that's the matter. But eventually he finds the central head, which he severs and buries, and it's still hissing as he buries it yet. Now, there are a lot of things that we can and could say about desires from this, but we don't want to get too far out on all of this. The point we're trying to get at is the centralness of desire. We want to get at the heart of it. I promised you last night, if I remembered an anecdote from my own life, I would tell it, because it really is illustrative of the principle of desire. As you know, about 28 years ago, somewhere in there, I had cancer. And during the cancer, I had an unfortunate episode with my ex-wife. And toward the other end of the cancer, I have the moon opposite Neptune in my horoscope. When the sun by progression came square to Neptune is when the cancer was discovered, and then for the next 4 years I did an alternative therapy and struggled with it, and at the end of 4 years I had to have a half a lung resected, and that occurred, the second flare-up occurred when the sun by progression went square to the moon. So there were terminal events at the beginning of that episode and at the end. And in the first session, my ex-wife did not know how to deal with my being ill, and was mildly treacherous. Well, she has since seen the light, and we are very good friends with each other. And I can't talk about all kinds of other people's lives. I can talk about my own. I can't talk about others. But at any rate, things are excellent between us. And at the final terminus, I almost married another woman. The only woman I've ever asked to marry me. Three different times, she's backed out, virtually at the altar. It was sort of like Charlie Brown with the football, remember that? It was that kind of a situation. And from the reason I'm telling these stories is I don't want to talk about the people involved, but I realized that the moon opposite Neptune indicated a kind of emotional treachery. And I was most vulnerable through my partner, because the moon is in the seventh house. And I was vulnerable to that kind of treachery at the same time that I had the cancer. And by pondering on it and praying on it, I came to the realization that, as in most cases, within the cancerous tumor, there was an entity. And that entity was product of guilt, product of guilt for not forgiving myself. I think what occurred, though I don't have absolute proof on this, but what resonates in my soul is that in a previous life I was treacherous and was to people who looked to me. I was not faithful to their looking to me to help them. And though Christ may have forgiven me, I didn't forgive myself, which is sort of playing God. And that lack of forgiveness is what became the cancerous tumor. And this is why I had to go through these experiences of minor treachery to realize what it is like to be in a vulnerable place and to look to somebody and for them to not be there. And the thing that came out of it, and that started all of this thinking, much of which is going to be in both of these sets of talks, is that the reason I was treacherous was because of some kind of desire. Now, I don't know that it was a single desire, and everything inside of me has told me that it is desire as a whole, getting at that central head, the head of the Hydra, which guides everything else. Obviously, why would you be born with the Sun in Scorpio if desire wasn't the central thing that you were supposed to work with in your life? And so the whole notion of the labors of Heracles and the way the desire body is overcome, it is overcome by going to the central issue. Now, I don't believe, you couldn't explain to the rugged ancient Greek people that you tame a hydra, which would probably be a much better myth, but you have to slay it, and you have rough, people, and rough people, you know, that's, they understand the story in that way. We must work with desire, not merely desires. We have to get at the whole idea of wanting something. This is why the whole overall idea of mood is so important. Unless you can understand the poise or the state of wanting that is in the desire body as a whole, you'll never ever be able to work with desire. This is something I find myself repeating again and again, because I keep getting caught by it again and again, and that is that we are unconscious to a lot that happens in our nature. We're, a lot of it is subconscious or unconscious to our waking consciousness, and unless we have a full, clear, wide awake view of things, we're always going to be surprised or fooled. It's like the desire nature is just waiting. You know, like people get angry when they're tired. You see a little child get angry when they're tired. It happens with adults. That's not, has nothing to do with the tiredness. It is that desire that wishes to express itself quite rashly has been there all the time. And when you're tired, you lower your resistance, and then the desire comes out. The tiredness didn't create the desire. It was there all along. Yeah, the desire to express energy unabated. The desire body lives. The lower self, or that pseudo-ego that lives in the desire body, loves to revel in any expression of desire. And if anger comes charging out, it feels great to that. There's some people that feel great with all kinds of really primitive things. Yes. Yeah. All right. Let's get back on the track of where we're going, which means back on the, before we go off in the next epicycle or something like that. Let's renew what we're trying to do, or restate or review what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand desire so that we can work on it. We're trying to understand desire by the study of astrology. To do that, we're studying astrology as a way to focus our attention on the desire world. We learned that there are things in the desire body that are not treated by the horoscope, like the influence of nationality spirits or religious spirits or things like that. So the horoscope, as we know it now, doesn't show everything. We learned that the desire world is a whole, and that each of our desire bodies is a whole, and that in that whole there is a basic logic. Actions or behaviors or all the minutiae, the little things that happen along the way, the outbursts of desire, are in us just like the idiosyncrasies of animals. They are ways which desire is expressed, hopefully to purposeful end, though in humans we have become so arrogantly egoistic that we just do these things to satisfy ourselves, to sate our desire nature. Again, the idiosyncrasies, the behavioral actions, can only be understood within the context of the whole and its basic purposes. Now, if astrology is going to be effective, it must be like what it is a representation of. It must be capable of representing wholes. And it must do it in such a way that it points to the components of wholes. Now, we've seen that astrology has not been used to find things like nationality, spirits, and things like that. It could probably be developed to do that, but that's kind of a stupid task, because less and less people are under the influence of race spirits or nationality spirits or cultural spirits. By the time you get the astrology developed that way, it would be out of, it wouldn't be worth it anymore. And it would be such a complex astrology. Soon everybody's going to have clairvoyance and be able to see for yourself, oh yeah, that guy's got that really strong tone of racial influence in him, yeah. So it doesn't, there's some things that it doesn't pay to study with astrology. And we get at it anyway by intuition. If you don't have intuition and you're trying to do astrology, you better look on practices for developing intuition, because astrology is much too big to try to do it intellectually. Astrology, if it is used spiritually, is symbolically representative of what it is points to, or what we're trying to get at. If we don't get stuck into abstracted material symbolism, astrology is right within the cosmos. Cosmologically, the stuff that the cosmos is made of, and even the laws and the principles, are themselves of such tones and qualities that they are the stuff that astrology points at. So, astrology, just as we saw with the labors of Heracles, has a cosmological component to us, to it. It should be obvious to us now that we are integral microcosms. Each of us and our spiritual being is the focus of the whole universe. And therefore our horoscope, when it is a focus of the whole universe from a given time at a given place, we see everything right in front of us. Now, yesterday it was said, though not very clearly, and we'll be talking about it a lot tonight and the next two nights, that from the perspective of the desire world, the planetary spirits draw on the moods of the signs, and they're sort of like rejuvenative organs. We know in the Rosicrucian philosophy that in our desire bodies we have vortices. The forehead, near the back of the head, at the voice box, near the genitals, at the knees, and the main vortex is at the in the area near the liver. And that fresh desire material comes out from an inner dimension in the desire world into the desire body, and then it goes back into the vortices And our consciousness and our desire expression depends on the kind of desire material we're working with and the vortex that it goes back into the inner dimension at. In an almost inverted way, an inverse way, the planets, according to the backgrounds that they have, are constantly pouring new, recycled, fresh desires into the cosmos. So that the cosmos is a shifting mood with colors being, and variations on the colors. You know, there are all kinds of reds, all kinds of blues. You know, if you just go to an art museum, you just see hundreds and hundreds of different reds meaning different things. And they're constant. So the atmosphere of the desire world, or the mood of the desire world, is constantly being refreshed. It's constantly being changed. And some of the tones and qualities of the desire world change very, very slowly over millions or hundreds of millions of years, and then there are very momentary changes that happen quite quickly. The second hand in this cosmic clock that shows the timing of everything, how the destiny works out so that we desire the thing, and that desire is satisfied at just the right time, even if our desire happens to be some kind of great sorrow, because that's what we need to learn the truth of something. The timing of that is almost perfect. There are cycles within cycles within cycles, and you know, it's embarrassing, because we go through different experiences and we get whammed just the way we need to get whammed at just this exactly the right time. And then something wonderful happens to us. We understand something and we feel it and we know the truth of it, and it happens just at the right time. And that all is with our harmony with the cosmos. Like our desire body is attuned to the cosmos, even if our waking conscious we are not. Sometimes the smaller cycles are fads. Sometimes they are important short seasons where we have a chance to learn something, and if we learn it, fine. If not, we miss it, and then we'll have to wait until there's another season like that. If we look at the cosmology, it isn't all in the desire world, but the Saturn period, the Sun period, the Moon period, and the Earth period that we're going through now, each of those periods is a spiritual mood. And so this is what we're working in. Now the desire world is in the phenomenal realms. And the phenomenal realms include the physical plane with the etheric and the chemical subdivisions, the desire world and the region of concrete thought. So it is a phenomenal world. A world where there are beginnings and where there are ends. In reflection, in the transcendent, we'll have to draw one of those inadequate pictures. Chard is going to have seen this picture enough times so that what's that? No, someday that you'll get a fascination with spiritual mathematics, and you'll do conic sections and understand the spiritual world from conic sections. I thought about trying to do that, but I have to go learn too much mathematics. Concrete thought, desire, etheric. Actually, all of this whole lens of the eye, human spirit, life spirit, divine spirit. The human spirit is the transcendent reflection of the desire world. It is the realm of the self. It is the realm of the universal ideas. It's transcendental, so it is universal. It doesn't have any beginning or end. But it is manifest enough so that it has an internal structure. Whether that internal structure is the formula or the mathematical idea that says it's this and it can't be this or this or this, or whether it's the moral of a story so that the story makes sense in abstract because that moral can't be this, but it is this, and it is, that's the way the, so it's both universal and pointing toward the concrete at the same time. So there are these universal ideas, and they're not all simple ideas like mathematical ideas. They are ideas that have the basis of all life. We're going to come back to them in just a little bit. But where the self is, the colorful self and all of the ideas, that is reflected into the desire world. We're going to be talking in the other talks tonight and tomorrow night about how one can understand the desire world by looking at color wheels and at color spheres. It's going to be somewhat simplistic, but it does get the idea across. And it's simplified. But in reality, the desire world is very, very complex. There are all kinds of feelings that are going on all of the time. And it's almost overwhelming. There have been a number of people who have opened desire world clairvoyance and have shut it off because there is so much and it is so chaotic. Symbolically, in a lot of myths and stories, the desire world is seen as a tangled forest because there's so much going on and all the creatures living in it, like entities and things like that. That's a pretty good symbol in this world for something that is even much, much more complex on the other side. So we talked about animal group spirits and such being there, but we build our character. We build our emotional nature from the very stuff of the desire world, including the transcendent ideas that run through all the species. For example, we can say that sheep and rams are ruled by Aries, and that people who have strong Aryan influences in their desire natures or in their general mood of life are people who try to ram things through. Or we may say that raccoons, which are nocturnal and prefer to wash their food with fresh water, that they are Cancerian, and that they're likely to be very clean people if people have a lot of Cancerian influences. For example, somebody like a Cancer with Virgo rising is one of those people that washes their hands maybe 30 times a day or something like that. And a good example is standing right before you. I have a strong Scorpion influence and I have Virgo rising, so I'm not always the most strong-willed person in the world, and I have bad posture. And for a long time among all of my friends, because of my I have the sun rising well, Mercury rising well after the sun, and I used to do a lot of post-mortem analysis, and for a long time I was known as Richard the Buzzard, Richard the Vulture, because I was looked like a, and there are even times that I used to sit on chairs like a vulture sits on a tree, and I'd pick things apart, you know, and it was apt. So, but we're not going to talk about all of those ideas. We're not going to talk about all of the moods of the signs of the zodiac. We're just trying to get the feel how astrology carries all of those moods in it. For example, handwriting is frozen thought and feeling. And the quality of your handwriting, you can look at handwriting and say, wow, that person is really nervous and erratic. It's like the handwriting is splattered onto the page rather than something that is flowing and rhythmic and such like that. And what we're trying to say is that the mood of the cosmos at the moment of the birth represents the mood of the individual born at that time. And that all of the components of that person's character, they're working out the same creative ideas that are the ideas that produce the different species or that produce the different plants, only we work them out in a psychological way, and that all of these moods are what we take and what we crystallize into history by the living out of our lives. It's important that we do this because the more we understand mood, the more we can accept people as wholes. And the more we accept them as wholes, the more we can be tolerant of their idiosyncrasies and all those little things that bother us. And if for no other reason to look at a whole, you know, we don't judge a person. Like, remember the pardon? Richard Nixon. People were outraged. See him get it and get it. And the line that comes down when people are pardoned is, well, they did so much service to society. And that sounds like a cop-out to somebody who wants to see real hard justice. But if you think about it, it really is looking at somebody's life as a whole. It's looking at it. I don't mean this to let Richard Nixon off the hook or anything like that, but when such a statement is made,